Hi everyone, you're listening to CIDR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam peoples. You just heard the prologue from the podcast Diagnosis Grad School, which is a series that explores the many challenges disabled academics deal with inside education institutions in the hopes of shifting the university experience for current and future disabled graduate students. This is a special broadcast episode for Global Accessibility Awareness Day, and our theme today is accessibility and performance. Before this, if you've been tuning in, we've had some great content, some great music, and it's just been a very exciting day here at CIDR. I am going to be in conversation with Olivia Dressinger, who is the creator of the podcast series Diagnosis Grad School. She's also a disability scholar, filmmaker, and writer. Hi, Olivia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So how I asked you this when we were listening to your prologue, but I don't know. Tell us how it felt listening to your prologue.
Oh, it feels kind of surreal. Like, also just being in the office, it's really nice. I've never done live radio before. I've always been a please pre-record me beforehand sort of person. So this is a nice experience to actually talk live face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely something raw about it, and it's like this is me unedited, unfiltered, and I don't know, it can be freeing. Maybe I'm biased.
I guess because I like this podcast, I can edit it so much and write the script, record it, re-record it, then edit the audio. I am such an editing person that live is terrifying, but I think it's fun so far.
Yay. No, I totally feel you. I've definitely been on the end of doing podcasts and just being a serial editor with audio storytelling and with my writing work. And I just have to stop myself from like, okay, I'm not going to edit this anymore. So I listened to the first two chapters of your podcast, and it's so incredible. The sound is beautiful. It's so immersive. And with just the content that you bring forward, I really enjoyed and appreciated how you take into consideration the different arenas. So you're talking about academia, you're talking about literature, and just being a literature nerd, I just had a blast. Revisiting Phantom of the Opera in the first chapter, and then Frankenstein, and you also talk about personal accounts, so there's that relatability factor, and then there are interviews. So just like there's a lot going on, and why don't we start with you just telling me a little bit about Diagnosis Grad School in your own words.
Well, yeah, it's a podcast series, 5 episodes. There's a prologue and an epilogue, which is kind of more like personal narrative focused. And then the other 3 kind of in the middle things, 2 of them have, like some history things about disability, and then literature, and then interviews. And the literature aspect, I think, was really important for me. I wanted to write about these characters. Like, I write about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and also Octavia Butler's Parable series, because I just always have wanted to do something about Butler since undergrad, about disability. And I thought that hopefully that will also be a way to draw in non-disabled listeners to understanding or feeling or kind of seeing kind of disabled experiences where maybe they hadn't read those stories with a disability lens before. Just kind of like a variety show. It's kind of like, especially with the sound design, kind of making it like a, yeah, just like a fun, immersive, as you said, variety show of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Definitely. I think with the literature and those really famous sort of points of contact for people to enter this conversation, because if not everybody, most of us grew up reading Frankenstein, and just listening to your podcast and you talking about it through a disability lens was so refreshing and kind of made me think of my own interpretation and how disabled characters have always been there, even if they've been misunderstood or misrepresented. And so that was just wonderful to kind of have that lens, and then drawing parallels to academia through it. Kind of backtracking a little bit to our theme, I'm curious to hear if you have any thoughts on accessibility and performance, since that is our theme for today. And I often feel that those two are such broad and perhaps can be loaded terms.
So what do you want me to speak on? Like disability and performance?
Accessibility and performance.
Accessibility and performance. I guess, like, in terms of my own work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess accessibility and performance, for me, it's very, like I've already said, kind of like the ability to edit and kind of choosing mediums that aren't on the fly, or kind of I can do independently when I'm feeling well, that give me a lot of agency and a lot of creative fulfillment through that, you know, just feeling like I'm a normal person, you know, writing these scripts and then performing them kind of on my own time alone, which I do enjoy, and then kind of sending them out into the world. That is kind of my accessible creative freedom, I would say, as a chronically ill performer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Thank you for sharing that. And when you were creating this podcast, was there anything surprising that you discovered about yourself or others, or found something that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, well, I think especially the prologue, which just played, I hadn't wanted to really revisit that feeling or that experience because it just brought me so much shame, and it was such a terrible point in my life, and I just felt just so bad in the university that I was at. And so kind of rereading through those emails that I tried to include, I was just so embarrassed. And I was like, you know what? I'm sure, like, there's so many students who are always sending these types of emails. I shouldn't be embarrassed. I know that a lot of people are struggling in academia. And just figuring out how to turn that into a story. And that made me feel a lot better, honestly, like kind of processing that experience. And then especially when I got to the interview stage, I mean, I did interview a lot of people who I already knew, mm-hmm. And were, you know, pretty familiar kind of with their experiences that ended up in the podcast. But actually before that, I had conducted 5 other interviews that didn't end up in the podcast.
Wow.
Only because my computer crashed.
Oh, no.
And the hard drive just died and I couldn't save it. I took it in, blah, blah, blah. They're no longer there. But those conversations were really enriching as well, because they are from people I hadn't known, and they were from very different departments. And that was really, like, you know, interesting for me to see the very different problems that exist in different programs around accessibility and particular disabilities that these people, these graduate students had. For instance, there was someone in science who was like, well, if you have like a physical disability or chronic illness, there's a lot of lab work, and depending, sometimes you have to do field work, which requires you to be, you know, physical, able-bodied in a particular way, and that's like a really big barrier to being in science. And I was like, oh, I've never thought about that, because I just type on a laptop and read and write, and thinking about barriers for me within that very specific program. So yeah, that was really, I mean, yeah, like I'm talking about this and it's not in the podcast, so I'm sorry. But I think also creating this podcast, like it's just a step, like I'm just one person and this is what I wanted to put together. But I think, yeah, just already the interviews and listening to other people's stories, like I hope more people do stuff on this topic because I wasn't able to cover like what needs to be covered, you know, not nearly as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, tech difficulties are real. That's just unfortunately part of the process. Well, you talked about the shame and guilt, which is, I'm sure a lot of folks can relate to that. And I thought your prologue, which you titled "The Absent Student," was really powerful, because I was just reminded of being back in school and how there was a lot of emphasis placed on being regular and punctual, which, like, I get it. You're trying to teach young folks the importance of being consistent and showing up and all that. But then it's really black and white, and often there is a lot of shame and sort of pathologizing of folks who aren't showing up. And it's like maybe something is going on and they're not doing it on purpose, or like the absentee. So it's very interesting. I think there is so much there, and we're taught this since we're really young.
Yeah, I mean, the absent student is always like often labeled as the bad student.
Mm-hmm.
And you carry that with you, and you're already struggling, obviously, because you're being absent for a reason. Like,
yeah,
I wanted to be there. Like, I like learning. I like mm-hmm. working. I always like doing those things. And just the sense of badness, though, mm-hmm. is not helpful. And
no.
I want to do away with that in academia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or these ideas of professionalization or professionalism. I think we need to look at that and see how it's not helpful for a lot of people, or like, yeah, who has made these this criteria.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just before you in other interviews, a lot of folks touched on perfectionism and how we're realizing now perfectionism is a construct under capitalism and white supremacy, and it's actually doesn't serve us. There is no room for nuance, and it just really upholds the status quo in a lot of ways. So just kind of talking more about academia, you talk a lot about being a grad student in your podcast and coming to terms with being disabled, and now you're pursuing a PhD. So in what ways has your life and perspective changed or not changed? Or I guess I'm kind of just curious about kind of like where you're at.
Mm-hmm. I guess where am I at right now with academia?
Sorry for the existential question.
No, I mean, before we started talking on air, we were talking about, you know, this pull towards academia. And I did take time off between my master's before coming back. And, you know, I guess I'm an academic inside of me because I had to come back, and I really like doing research, even if I don't always like this institution a lot of the time. Trying to figure out just, you know, how to support myself and do creative research because it just fulfills me so much. And the kind of work that I do, I believe in, and I want to keep doing that. I guess that's where I'm at. I am quite, you know, like most people, probably very burnt out from the pandemic. I started, you know, at the height of COVID, my PhD experience, which I did not want to talk about in the podcast. I just wanted to kind of, you know, have the more fun literature and sound elements and kind of distance myself from COVID thinking. Maybe someone else can tackle that, like, you know, a few years out from the reality of this. But I guess maybe not the most positive answer, but the most honest answer. And I'm in the stage where I will be writing my dissertation very soon. Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's very exciting. What's your PhD about?
It's about ethos, which is credibility, and medically unexplained illnesses. I had thought about this idea before COVID hit and long COVID, which would fall under a medically unexplained illness or a contestable illness. Just kind of thinking about people with these vague, hard to detect, illnesses, like they have these vague symptoms. It's not showing up on the tests. What that does to their credibility as an ill person, and you know how that follows through into their relationships with physicians, friends, family, strangers. So it's another kind of heavy topic. I've also, like this podcast, been trying to think about how to make it more fun for readers while also still, you know, talking about the challenges that people experience in this domain.
Mm-hmm. I think you did a great job. I was talking before the interview. I was just telling you, Olivia, that it is very engrossing, and I quite enjoyed the music. It's beautiful and really takes you on a journey, just the kind of like ebbs and flows in your voice and the different elements you bring into the podcast. So I will ask you this on air again, like, tell me a bit about the music and kind of like how you went around making decisions of like what to use and stuff like that.
Well, shout out to my partner, Tristan Douglas, the sound editor. We would just hole ourselves up in our apartment and do the sound together. And, we kind of like humor. We like, we like to kind of do remixes of pop songs, to kind of hype it up, keep the energy going.
Tell me the last remix of a pop song you folks did.
Oh, I mean, I think we did the Frankenstein, I Don't Want to Be a Monster Anymore is in the next episode by Rina Sarami. I don't know how to pronounce her last name ever, but she's a great artist. Mm-hmm. So he kind of just did a little edit. But before that, we had done a podcast about Britney Spears and mental disability and voting. So we did some Britney edits, which was really fun.
Love that.
Just opportunities to play with sound in that way. And then we included, you know, songs from Phantom of the Opera, which was, you know, my my like teenage heart was just swelling. Aww. You know, being able to use that.
Well, love that. And as we already have established that I'm biased as a big Phantom of the Opera fan. And I was like, heck yeah, any excuse to revisit that. Similar to Frankenstein, there's just so many layers that you can unravel with whatever you want to call it, the masked man, with Frankenstein's monster. They're just very complex characters.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was talking earlier, I was quite intrigued by your deep dive into literary figures with a disability justice lens, and who are artists and learners, and with Octavia Butler's
Olivia Butler
with Octavia Butler's work as well, and the parallels between them and our current attitudes towards folks with disabilities, be it visible or invisible. And unfortunately, a lot is quite similar, you know, and not, I mean, yeah, things have shifted a lot, but also not a lot. And so I wonder, I guess this is a very roundabout way to just ask you about the societal expectations around health and illness. And I wonder if you can talk about some of those expectations that either you have encountered or witnessed.
Mm-hmm. I think there's quite a few ways to answer this. I'll try to like trim it down, but I guess there's always like the disabled person has to prove they're disabled. People are always suspicious. And I think this is due to, yeah, like capitalism, white supremacy, like, you know, making your body work, work, work. That kind of informs, I think, how people view disability. You know, like a body that can no longer work in expected ways, expected hours, for how long, you know, and how they're doing it. And so there's always this, yeah, compulsory need to prove, diagnose in specific ways disabled or ill bodies. And a lot of bodies get left out of that or stigmatized way more. And I guess, yeah, what do we do with that? And okay, so like, how does that work in academia? Maybe I can bring this into like a personal realm. Mm-hmm. I do get into this in the podcast. This is, I guess, was the easiest way of kind of setting up an example of this kind of proving disability. Diagnosis takes a long time. You know, access to healthcare is a privilege. There's not a lot of doctors, primary doctors anymore, it seems, or not seems, like it's true. But so to be deemed certified as disabled as a graduate student, for instance, you have to, well, first have a documented diagnosis, and then you have to have a letter written by your doctor and submit that to, here at UBC, it's the Center for Accessibility. And then they kind of are like, okay, in our books, you're disabled. And then here are accommodations for you. But it's a very imperfect gatekeepy situation where it's really about, I would say, just money instead of just expanding what disability is, expanding what accommodations for lots of different people could look like, expanding what work and labor looks like, what is, like, who is valuable in society. I know I'm going, like, I don't know, I'm going beyond your topic. But
it's totally on
you
point.
Know? And yeah, just kind of valuing stuff beyond, like, hyper able labor. I think that's maybe other people today have talked about kind of this thing that disability likes to kind of try to claw away at, is just like the value that, yeah, disabled bodies bring to the world. Yeah, sorry, I know I'm like probably all over the place.
No,
there,
not
but
at all. I think, yeah, no, you definitely raised some good points around the rigid expectations, and they are quite harmful, obviously. And something that I was talking to Kyle about in our interview earlier today was, I remembered we interviewed someone for the Accessibility Collective podcast, All Access Pass, and we interviewed Madeline, who said something that really struck a chord with me. And she said, we're all temporarily able-bodied.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we forget that.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of becomes, as you already touched on, us versus them, and very self-serving. And it's like, oh, like, why do we have to think about that? Or like, and it's a shame that often accessibility is an afterthought.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, just, yeah, the us versus them mentality. I think, like, because I grew up with my mom was very sick growing up. So I guess I was already always exposed to kind of like disability, even though that was never, she was never named as disabled. Very confusing, but probably common with, with people and families who have, you know, different illnesses, but it's not talked about. But yeah, this us versus them, like, please, please, we need to stop doing that. Because there's also so many people who have disabilities or, you know, illnesses, but they don't identify as disabled or ill, which is totally fine.
Yeah.
And so it does, like, there's a lot of us out there, even if we're not, like, explicitly publicly, you know, claiming that that identity. And, yeah, just kind of like, why do we have to be suspicious of certain bodies or how they're doing things or operating in the world? And maybe COVID heightened that way more too. I think things got pretty divisive.
Absolutely. And just and what you're talking about, just like burnout with, I mean, life is hard as it is, and then with like the burden of over explaining and kind of the guilt and shame around like I could be doing this or I could be doing that, I imagine. And then also often, at least in my perspective, we like to put folks from different marginalized communities on pedestals. And then like, oh, if they can do it, why can't you? And then you can call it inspiration porn, or like in a lot of racialized communities, like East Asian and South Asian, it's the model minority myth. And then we're just...
so much pressure.
So much pressure, and just pitting people against each other. And yeah, we can go into the whole critique of DEI, but I think it often can do that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
The good, like there's this something that I'm always very sus about is like the good immigrant versus the bad immigrant dichotomy, which people don't explicitly say, but it's like very like there in the subtext. And so I guess I'm just kind of drawing parallels to
I think it's
disability,
like, again, these like this kind of maybe one way of looking at productivity or the value of your laboring body or things like that, or you know, or making money kind of contribute to you being like a good citizen or like contributing in some way. And I don't know, like there's just someone could be talking to you and having a really good conversation, and I think that's like really valuable, productive thing to be doing. Or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely, right? How we see productivity. And I have I mean, I'm sure you, me, and so many of us have a lot of internalized capitalism. And
internalized capitalism.
This is the first time I'm saying it, and you know what?
Trademark right now.
I am going to. I coined it, so you heard it here first, folks. But that's kind of the messaging I grew up with, and a lot of like how there's so much shame when someone calls you lazy, right? Or nobody, or that kind of guilt of like, I'm being lazy, or I'm slacking, or I'm being a procrastinator.
I'm not doing anything right now.
I could be doing so much. And oh my god, maybe, I mean, also it's okay to be lazy. And because the opposite is like productivity, which obviously we know our self-worth is tied to that. And it's very dehumanizing.
Or competing. For things.
Totally. And also, again, in a lot of like visibility, politics, and justice, it's like there's only few seats on the table, and you're kind of it's instilled in you, like you have to kind of fight for it and be better than like the other marginalized folks, which is. Pretty horrible, to say the least.
I remember, this was a few years ago, like pre-COVID or whatever, I was at the bus stop, and you know, they have like advertisements in like the bus shelters, like the big posters, and there was a poster for, I won't name the university, I think it was like a college, anyways, it was like for a program, I think it was like cooking, and then it was like a picture of a person in their like chef outfit, and it was just like, be better than everybody else, like come to this school, and like it was like basically like win, win, win,
yeah.
like and also just like yeah, just crush your opponent kind of advertising. And I just thought it was so bizarre to see that. Yeah, like you said, like there's only a few positions. Like, you have to excel. Or like, I don't know. And it's like, that's so sad.
Because I know.
Everyone can have really good things about them.
Yeah, so. I'm like the least competitive person. At least, I don't know, I like to believe that. I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to compete with anybody. Like, what?
So you don't like winning at games or something?
No, I do like winning. I get bitter when I don't win. But I just mean, like, in life, if that makes sense.
I'm joking. Who doesn't like to win, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Like, give me the little things. But it's just exhausting. I'm like, I'm not even going to play this game. So I'm not really losing or winning.
And it gets in the way of community and relationships.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So why would you want to do that?
Yeah. No, exactly. Like 100%. And you're not. Yeah. Yeah. And it's also a very an individualist mindset of like, yeah. And I don't know, like maybe this is a stretch, but like conquering and kind of. Get at it before anybody else can be also very extractive.
Totally.
Versus like sharing, I don't know, what we learned in kindergarten, which I don't know people remember anymore.
One kid would not share the blocks with me, though, and I will always remember that, because I wanted to make like a geometric multicolored flower, and he was hogging a particular shape I needed.
You know what? I bet you he's a finance bro right now.
Oh, there you go. Wouldn't be shocked. Yeah.
Yeah.
Couldn't spare one, you know?
Yeah. Just give me one. Come on. Yeah. No, I mean, this has been a really fun conversation. We still have a bit of time, but I have definitely lost my train of thought because that's what happens.
I'm throwing you off. I'm talking about
blocks. That's important. It starts from day one, right? But it's never too late to learn, though.
See, it's your first educational experience making a podcast about educational systems.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's very, I don't know, meta, I guess. I was just saying it's never too late to learn. So there you go. I don't know if anyone's like, oh, my God, I didn't share blocks in kindergarten. I'm doomed.
I have been having to learn how to share my food lately. My boyfriend gets after me for that.
Okay.
I'm a very, like, food hoggy person. So I'm kind of like, here, you can have, like, two of my fries. It, like, kills me inside.
Oh, so sweet of you.
He's like, I see you're trying so hard right now to be doing this.
Order your own fries.
But I'll eat his. It's not fair. It's
okay.
Not fair.
No, Olivia, come on. You lost me. You lost me there.
I'm the bad person here.
I guess going back to our conversation, something I want to hear from you is, and this is maybe a personal question for me, because I was talking to you about academia before, and so maybe I'm asking this in self-interest, but do you have any words of advice or wisdom or just anything for aspiring master's and PhD students with disabilities who might be hesitant to pursue academia?
This was definitely, a thing that I asked all the interviewees. So I will kind of take it through their wisdom as well. You know, they said, find a good supervisor. I very much agree with that. You need to find someone in academia who has your back and wants to actually support you and you get along with but have good boundaries with. And the other thing was, finding community in academia is really important. And then if I were to add kind of other things is find people who have won awards already and grants and try to talk to them and see their grant applications so that you have a good template for writing your own grants. Because I feel like this is something that, I don't know why, is kept so secret in university, like this weird intellectual way of writing. There's like never any examples online. It's all very much like you have to find someone who has already written one. And I think this is really keeps a lot of people out from accessing money for research that they're already doing that is valuable. So that would be also my contribution to the tip jar about academia that I've always been annoyed by, I would say.
That's I mean, I didn't know that, so clearly it's I don't know, I guess more hidden or concealed,
very much hidden.
And yeah, it's this weird mentality with, like, I don't know if what you want to call it, like intellectual elitism, or
they're afraid that just everyone will learn how to do it, and then how will we select? Like, they're putting an extra layer of, like, an extra barrier up, basically, for people who, you know, might not have someone they know in academia, might have never, like, no one in their family has been in academia, you know, like, I don't know, it keeps a lot of people out.
Absolutely. So, like, oh, helping people. Who does that?
Helping people with this very specific writing style that will give you access to money to support yourself? No, we're not going to do that. No.
What a concept. Well, thank you for that. And I suppose just... and this is a really big question, so I apologize in advance. But how do, I don't know, like, I mean, obviously there were a lot of problems and structural barriers and systemic barriers that exist in academia around disability and sexism and racism and, like, all those isms, but specifically around disability and different kinds of disabilities. What are things... some things that you wish specifically able-bodied people, but maybe just kind of everyone, understood about folks with disabilities within academia?
What do I wish people understood? We're here. There's a lot of us. If, you know, there's probably a lot of untenured, you know, professors who are not out for a lot of reasons, like they could lose their job. We are here and we're valuable, I would say. I think that's actually something I touched in the epilogue, was just like, I was quoting disability scholar Allison Kafer, where I don't remember, like, you know, word for word the quote, but it was like, a future without disability is, like, seen as, like, you know, that's the thing that people want, but, like, what is a future with disability? Like, why is that not seen as valuable? And I think that I would just say, like, you know, like, with everyone in academia, the thing that you bring is just how you view the world and approach your research through that. And disabled people are doing that. And I just, that's valuable, period, you know? And yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's, like, invaluable. And again, yeah, the construct of what is valuable and what is not is... really messed up. I really liked chapter 2 of your podcast where you interviewed, I believe their name was Emily Sarah, and just talking about the importance of having disabled educators. And it was just so beautiful listening to her talk. And I was like, oh yeah, I don't know if in my years and years in school and uni I've ever had a prof, I mean, at least not, like, a physically disabled prof, and those folks are definitely just, like, kept out, and not even, there's no kind of, maybe even just thinking of, like, oh, we could be changing things, or we could be making things accessible, but just definitely pushed out of academia and educational institutions.
And the thing I loved about what Emily Sarah has to say about her education, like, her pedagogy, which I thought was, like, whoa, this is, you can do that, was that, you know, with her students, she said sometimes, like, if a student can't do an assignment, they just don't do the assignment, and it's fine.
Oh my God. Radical.
And I was like, oh, but so many people would be like, that's unfair to the other students, they're not learning, they're lazy, you know, all those things that are just going to be flung at you, and it's just like, they just can't do it. What's the harm in that? it's fine. Mm-hmm. They can do, maybe they can have a conversation with her to, you know, engage or show that they're learning. You know, I don't know. There's just, I guess there's just so much like policing and like around pedagogy and the students and like grades and who's the it keeps going on back to who's the best.
Yeah.
You know, who's the smartest.
Totally.
Who's the most able. Who's the best student.
Yeah. Who's the best at like performing able-bodiedness.
Mm-hmm. And able-mindedness, you know.
Yeah. Also that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what would a university look like if most professors were down with, it's you can't do the assignment, that's fine.
Wow. That would be revolutionary.
Let's think of something else for you to do if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Wow. And it just goes back to also thinking, rethinking, I should say, of ways of learning, right? And as you said, there's so much policing and often learning and, again, going back to academia and educational institutions, can be very punitive.
You're going to fail. This is going to be on your record.
Yeah, you're doomed forever.
You won't get awards. You won't get future grants because they rely on the percent of your mark, know, to like kind of find who's the best to give the award to. Like, it all goes back to that.
Yeah.
And why, you know, I don't like that system.
No, totally. I actually, a few years ago, I was working on this national project with other researchers about, we're looking into mental health of students in Canadian universities, and it was very grim, as you can imagine. And people's mental health, and this was like peak COVID, people's mental health were tanking, and they were really struggling and just feeling very bitter up against academia and kind of like losing faith in it and just like asking for accommodation and having to like constantly like proof.
Mm-hmm.
We
will make you work through a global pandemic, you know, when you're dealing with so many different traumatic things. But we want you to turn in assignment 3 today.
Yeah.
You know, sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. On a maybe a bit of a lighter note, and I'm always just curious, and maybe I'm a bit of a nosy person, to like know kind of what inspires you and what keeps you going and where do you like what energizes you, Olivia?
What energizes me, I guess just in my personal life, my family, dogs. They energize me. Animals, you need that, obviously. And then obviously in like my professional life, like my work does energize me. It obviously, like, you know, this conversation goes to places that are not very happy when talk about these realities. But I think what energizes me is just hoping that it will help someone, that it will start to change things on a small scale. Because, you know, sometimes you can feel quite helpless when you see these kind of like larger systems. But I know personally people who are in these, you know, different systems that are trying to like make small changes, and that really changes your life if you meet them or, you know, get to know them and see what they're doing. So I don't know if that answer made sense, but
yeah it did. It's it can feel nonsensical, I suppose, to some people, but it's just pushing the envelope a little bit every day, just being a little spicy every day.
Yeah. And then going around and like, you know, throwing a bunch of treats at your dog or something seeing their happiness. And then, you know, finding that balance.
Totally. Or doing remixes of pop songs.
Yeah. And then just singing along to Britney,
God. Pop queen icon. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, definitely joy and silliness is very important.
Yeah, and I think I tried to do that with the podcast, is to bring some silly elements to it because, it's a lot. I want to take you on, like, I want to take listeners on a journey, and I want them to have different emotions. So, yeah.
I think you did that really well.
Thank you.
It just as I was talking earlier, it made me feel a range of emotions, and that's kind of the beauty of this discourse. It doesn't all have to be sad and
or inspirationally, yeah.
Also that, or mm-hmm. like, yeah, depressing, or like inspiration porn, mm-hmm. as we know, that's not cool. there's just again, obviously, it's a very complex topic, and it doesn't have to be heavy or something that just makes people think, oh, this is very uncomfortable, I don't want to engage with this kind mm-hmm. of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you do that, again, going back to history and literature. I think it was quite accessible looking into these folks who we all know, but perhaps don't really know.
I love that.
Yeah. You're just, I don't know, maybe just being philosophical here, but kind of just like peeling layers of the mask.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
So we are nearing the end, Olivia. Thank you so much for coming on air and chatting with me about your podcast. This was lovely.
Yeah, and the thing I'll say now, doing live radio for the first time, it's nicer because I actually get to hear you talk more and not just myself, because I feel like I just have to give a 10-minute answer, you know, like over the phone. So this was actually really joyful. Thank you for talking to me.
I love that. Yay. I'm just converting people today. Amazing. Thank you so much, Olivia. Olivia's podcast has also been airing on CADR, so check it out. And I will be playing chapter one of Diagnosis Grad School, titled Aristotle's Lonely Monsters. Enjoy and stay tuned for more special programming.